This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, federal pandemic funds for childcare are ending this year. We'll look at the ways that Wisconsin could improve access to affordable childcare around the state. Now, it's Food Friday. Food is one of the best ways to bring any family together. That's especially true for our next guests, their sisters who grew up learning Chinese cooking from their parents. In 2013, they started a family food blog, and now that's grown into a cookbook celebrating the flavors of China and their home kitchen. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What memories do you have of the kitchen bringing your family together? Did you find times in your adult life to get together with parents and cook some favorite dishes? Or do you bring kids in to the kitchen to work with you on making that family meal? And have you tried Chinese cooking of some sort in your kitchen? Do you have a wok? Do you have questions about how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah and Caitlin Leung, along with their parents Bill and Judy, are the authors of the new book, The Woks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. Sarah and Caitlin, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Now, Caitlin, can you talk about your family's food background and why this is so particularly important for you?
Yeah, our family is Chinese American, and we've always grown up kind of straddling those two worlds, and sometimes three worlds if you count the fact that my dad's Cantonese and my mom's Shanghainese. But food has always been super important to us as a family. You know, we grew up eating dinner together every night, or at least trying to, making an effort to, and cooking together. And yeah, I think over the years, it kind of quickly became apparent that me and Sarah had to roll up our sleeves and learn how to cook Chinese food and the food that we grew up with ourselves if we wanted to kind of keep it going for ourselves and the future.
Sarah, what are some of your first memories of actually working in the kitchen with your folks?
You know, I feel like every Chinese kid grows up being asked to make rice at some point, like make a pot of steamed rice. So that's probably like the first thing that I remember.
And let's talk about how this blog came to be. Caitlin, can you tell us a little bit about how this, you know, family love of cooking turned into your blog?
I'm actually going to pass it over to Sarah to answer that.
Go for it, Sarah.
Yeah, sure. So I think Caitlin is passing it to me because it's kind of it was my story of having like just graduated from college and being unemployed and unsure what to do next that kind of spearheaded the blog. So yeah, in 2013, my parents were actually living in Beijing in China. My dad had recently gotten a temporary work assignment there. And so we were apart. We were, you know, separated by continents and by many time zones. And we kind of realized, Caitlin and I, that we had no idea how to make the foods that we were craving, which were the ones that our parents prepared for us growing up. And so we decided to start the blog as a way to stay in touch with each other while my parents were abroad, and also as a way to record those recipes so that Caitlin and I would know how to make them for ourselves.
And Caitlin, what were some of the first recipes that you realized, hey, this is something that's going to be fun to do as a long distance family?
That's a great question. Honestly, I think the first recipes that we kind of thought of were the easiest ones, the low hanging fruit, if you will, of the stuff that me and Sarah had actually most successfully cooked together, because it was like, oh, well, duh, that's the very least we can do. And then pretty quickly we ran out of those. But one recipe that I remember is my mom's red braised pork belly, which is a super famous Shanghainese dish and one that we were very eager to get down on paper. All of us, not just me and my sister, but also my mom, who, you know, really, I think we all, at the start, we all really embraced documenting pretty much any recipe that came to mind because we all just thought it was such a cool idea. And I think my mom in particular was very much eager and almost felt a sense of urgency in passing the information on to sort of the new generation with, you know, her own daughters being the representatives of that, but also, you know, actually the people of our generation more broadly.
We're talking to Caitlin and Sarah Leung. It's Food Friday. They have a new cookbook out that they wrote with their parents. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story to share about cooking with your family, maybe handing down or receiving those great family recipes from a parent or grandparent, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got a few recipes from Sarah and Caitlin up at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll check a couple of those out in a minute. Now, Sarah, let's talk. You have a list of important equipment. No surprise. A wok is featured prominently in the list. I once owned a wok. I don't know much about wok quality, but I know this was not a good one. It did not enable me to cook great food. What for somebody like me who would like to have a good wok, what should I look for, Sarah?
Yeah, sure. So you're looking for a wok that's made with carbon steel. Carbon steel is a great material because it's lightweight, so you can actually handle the wok and lift it a lot easier than, say, a cast iron or a stainless steel wok. And it's also going to be relatively thin. And the reason for that is you want the wok to be able to heat up relatively quickly, especially when you've already added food to it. So a lot of wok cooking, particularly stir frying, involves cooking over very high heat. So you want a wok that's thin enough such that when you add food to it, it's going to be able to heat up that much more quickly after it's kind of cooled down, after you added those ingredients. Also, you're looking for, I suggest, a wooden handle. Sometimes these metal handles can get really hot when the wok is sitting on the stove. So a wooden handle just kind of prevents you from burning yourself. And a really nice lid as well, because the lid is going to allow you to do things like steam and braise in that wok, and even smoke things in your wok. So I would say those are my top tips for picking a wok.
And then, Caitlin, I understand you're responsible for something that shows up a lot in the book, a chili oil that we make at home. Then we've got it sitting around using a bunch of different dishes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's I feel like I'm the poster child for our homemade chili oil. Because it's definitely one of my favorites. And I feel like it was such a cool moment in sort of, quote unquote, the blog's history when we discovered how to make our own Sichuan style chili oil, because it's actually pretty deceptively simple. But, you know, until you figure out what those key steps are, you kind of can't imagine achieving those flavors in your own home kitchen. But yeah, basically it's as much a condiment as it is a cooking ingredient. So I think when we first discovered it, and we're a little bit more nascent in our Chinese cooking adventures, we were more likely to use chili oil as a condiment for, you know, noodles, fried rice, or dumplings, what have you. But we kind of graduated to cooking more Sichuan dishes like mapo tofu, where that calls for like a quarter cup of our homemade chili oil. So it's really great to make it at home, because you just do a little oil infusion. You pour hot oil, you pour that hot flavored oil over chili flakes, and you have a chili oil. And then you can use like massive quantities of it and not be worried about, you know, running out of a little jar that is, you know, admittedly can be kind of expensive. So yeah, definitely one of our faves. And if that's like, if you're looking for a starter recipe from the cookbook, I would say that's a really good one, because it kind of opens a lot of doorways.
And we've got that at WPR.org/Food Friday. And it stars in another dish we have up there, shortcut Dan Dan noodles. I'm looking at the picture in the book right now. Sarah, it looks delicious. Can you tell us about this dish a little bit?
Absolutely. So that dish was actually my sister's invention. So Dan Dan noodles it's a Sichuan dish. And it can be kind of complex to make it from scratch at home. So you're going to make a sauce. There's kind of this like relish of ground pork and an ingredient called sui mi yatai, which is a preserved vegetable that you can find in Chinese grocery stores. And you're going to boil noodles and all that. So the most difficult part of the recipe is actually creating, like, layering the flavors of the sauce. So the shortcut aspect of this recipe is making that sauce in advance, and it actually keeps for several weeks in your refrigerator. So you can just kind of pull out that jar of sauce anytime the craving for a bowl of noodles hits. And all you have to do is cook off the ground pork with a little bit of garlic, ginger, and that preserved vegetable I mentioned, and mix it with the boiled noodles, maybe throw a little bit of baby spinach in there, or you could also use like any leafy green that you like, mix it with the sauce, and you're good to go.
We're talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung on this week's edition of Food Friday. They are co-authors, along with their parents, of the new cookbook, The Walks of Life. They write the food blog of the same name. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you cook as a family? Did you cook with your parents growing up? Do you cook with your kids as you're raising them? Do you have favorite food traditions that were handed down? Could you write a book like our guests did, or would you want to? And what questions do you have about some of the Chinese cooking we are talking about? Do you have favorite dishes maybe you've had at a friend's, or maybe in your family growing up, or at a restaurant, and you'd like to try to create them at home? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Check out some recipes from our guests at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sarah and Caitlin Leung, co-authors of the new cookbook. The other co-authors are their parents, by the way. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. You can join in with your experiences, your questions with Chinese food, Chinese-American food, or cooking with your family at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I actually lived in Chengdu, Sichuan, for about 5 years, and my wife is from there. And we came back to the U.S. last year, and she's always cooking dishes that I remember. So a few of them I wanted to bring up was chuan chuan, which is kind of like a hot pot. I call it a hot pot for one. I know you guys were talking about dan dan mian, which is also really good. I like za jia mian, and of course, you know, the traditional Sichuan spicy hot pot. I also wanted to ask your two guests what their favorite local Sichuan food would be.
Great. Hey, Jack, thanks for sharing that experience. Let's start with Caitlin, a favorite Sichuan food Jack wants to know.
That's a great question, and I loved hearing about all of your favorite dishes. Mm. I have to say, I think the old standby Mapo tofu is my favorite.
And that's tofu, and it's usually got some pork in it. Do I have that right, Caitlin?
Yeah, it's like ground pork and like a spicy bean paste and chili oil laden sauce with Sichuan peppercorn, and it's really, really good.
And would it work with your ultimate chili oil, Caitlin?
It does indeed.
Excellent. Sarah, do you have a favorite to share with Jack?
Yeah, my favorite is a little bit of an obscure one. It's called Fuxi Fei Pian, and it's like, it's normally made with tripe and tongue, which I know is kind of polarizing, but it's really tasty. The sauce is incredible. The mixture of textures is really interesting. You can find it in the appetizer section of most Sichuan restaurants here in the U.S. And it's just a really classic Sichuan dish. And actually, in our cookbook, we have a vegan version of that dish. So the veganized version kind of uses different types of tofu and seitan to kind of mimic those textures and flavors. So if you're a little bit, you know, nervous to try tripe, the vegan version might be the way to go.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jack, at 800-642-1234. Kay joins us now in Madison. Kay, hi.
Hi. My aunt and uncle lived in Taiwan for many years when he was in the military, and she would send recipes to our family, and my mother would make sweet and sour pork or fried rice, and we really enjoyed it, and it was a nice change from Midwestern cooking.
And Kay, is that something you still make to this day?
Yes, yes, we still do. My mother modified the recipes a little bit, so I have to kind of go back and unmodify them a little bit to make them a little more traditional.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call. That reminds me of something I wanted to ask about. Your dad, let's throw this to Caitlin, does a lot in the way of Chinese-American cooking and in some ways adapting things from China and integrating them with, you know, maybe a common Midwestern dish or other parts of the country. What kind of things come out of that?
Yeah, my dad is definitely the point person on all things Chinese-American, Americanized takeout, restaurant-style cooking, because he actually had experience growing up working summer jobs and to pay for college and things like that in restaurant kitchens with my grandfather, his stepfather, who actually was a professional restaurant chef. And so a lot of his cooking know-how comes from the training that he got during those years. And then later, my grandparents actually opened their own Chinese restaurant. So he had even more experience kind of making those beloved Americanized dishes that kind of everybody knows and loves so well, no matter where you are across the country. And in terms of, I think, some highlights, his Chinese takeout fried chicken wings are really good. Mm. They like are so, so delicious. It's kind of the original recipe that my grandfather would make. And we've brought that forward into the on the blog and now into our cookbook.
We are talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung on Food Friday, their new cookbook with their parents. It's called The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese-American Family. Here's another one. Sarah, we've got a WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got your name on this in the cookbook here, Pork and Shrimp Shumai. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. So shumai is a dim sum dish. So it's a steamed dumpling with pork and shrimp. If you've ever been to dim sum, shumai is like one of the most recognizable or common items. And it's actually shocking how easy it is to make at home. In the recipe in the cookbook, we use a stand mixer actually to mix the filling because you want to really emulsify that filling together to get it to have that like the right texture. And to do that, you kind of have to stand there and stir for quite a while, but to have a stand mixer do it for you is that much better. And you can use store-bought Hong Kong style dumpling wrappers to make these or wonton wrappers. And you basically just fill the wrappers with the filling. You can put a little garnish on top if you like, but you don't have to, and you just steam them and they are delicious, particularly with Caitlin's chili oil or with some chili garlic sauce, which is also delicious.
We've got that up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, Caitlin, something that's been nagging at me since I started looking at your book right off the bat. You describe your family as a bunch of strong-willed individuals. Now, you know, my wife and I, when we cook together, we're very strong-willed and have very strong attitudes about what happens in the kitchen. We've learned one of us is the prep cook, the other one is the chef, and that's how we can work harmoniously. How do you manage four different personalities, either working together in the kitchen or, say, planning out a cookbook?
That's a good system. Not a bad system at all. I think over the years, we've definitely learned to, number one, play to each other's strengths, similar to you and your wife. But also, I think that as we work together and as a collective, we also have had to find or learn, perhaps, how to step aside and kind of let each individual perspective have its, you know, kind of time to, you know, breathing time for us all to kind of reflect on, to say like, okay, if somebody has a recipe idea or somebody has, you know, a topic that they want to talk about, like we all kind of evaluate it sort of equally, even though we are kind of parents and children, you know, which is like inherently a hierarchical relationship, but bringing that equality to the table when we do have our kind of blogging hat on and our cookbook hat on is definitely important. And, as we were developing the cookbook, we kind of had a system where we allocated everybody kind of the recipes that we thought that each of us would do best with. And then as we went along, it kind of became clear that, you know, different recipes were trickier than others. And we would sort of do like swap meet on recipes of like, oh, I'll trade you this recipe for that recipe, and kind of, you know, in that way really brought the same strengths that we have in the blog into the cookbook, which is that all of the recipes go through the gauntlet, I like to say, of four different perspectives, and you know, the evaluations and the kitchen skills that come with each of our unique backgrounds.
And Sarah, not every family is going to do a food blog or write a cookbook together, but can you give us some encouragement to, you know, get together between generations, talk about the foods we grew up with, and share those recipes and experiences with each other in our families?
Absolutely. I think it's so important to pass these recipes down, to write them down. If you have a favorite dish that, you know, your mom, your dad, your grandparents make, take the time to go and write that down, because, you know, once our elders pass on, those recipes often disappear. And we've heard so many stories of that from our readers of like, oh, I thought this recipe was gone forever, and you know, I tried yours and it tastes just like my, you know, what my dad used to make, and that kind of thing. We hear that so often. So I would just say, if you have recipes that you love, definitely take the time to reach out to your parents, to your grandparents, your great grandparents, really study what they're doing in the kitchen. You know, you can just make a fun afternoon of it. Just kind of watch what's happening, write it down. And then to send it out to like the rest of your family, that's like what a gift that is, you know? So I would highly encourage everybody to do that.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And Caitlin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Been talking to Sarah and Caitlin Leung, who write the food blog, The Walks of Life, along with their parents. And the four of them are the co-authors of this new cookbook we've been talking about. It's The Walks of Life, Recipes to Know and Love from a Chinese American Family. You can find some of those recipes we talked about today with Sarah and Caitlin online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try them out and let us know how it goes. And you could share your thoughts maybe about cooking with your family on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, what does it take for a country to be happy? Get the results of the World Happiness Index. Join the conversation. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the Friday News Roundup with an arrest in national security leaks, the president's trip to Ireland, and more. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, parents don't need to be reminded about the high cost of child care. The Economic Policy Institute says that a year of infant care in Wisconsin can cost more than a year of tuition at a public college. For a lot of Wisconsin families, child care costs are an economic necessity and a burden on the budget. Chances are that wherever you are, childcare is in short supply and high demand. The pandemic made access to affordable childcare worse, but federal pandemic assistance has been contributing $300 million a year to childcare in Wisconsin. That federal funding is coming to an end this year, leaving big questions about how childcare centers will be able to afford to keep their doors open and how families will be able to afford their necessary services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does childcare factor into your family budget? What's it been like to try to find affordable childcare, where you live? If you work in childcare, I'd love to hear about some of the challenges that you see. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vincent Lyles is executive director of Milwaukee Succeeds. That was launched by Greater Milwaukee Foundation in 2011. Aimed at improving educational outcomes for children in Milwaukee. Vincent, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's my pleasure. I'm happy to join you and your listeners this afternoon. I'm joined by my colleague, Daria Hall, who will be on in just a second as well.
And Daria Hall is the Early Childhood Education Director for Milwaukee Succeeds. Daria, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
And Vincent, you co-wrote a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel opinion piece this week, along with the CEO of the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Ellen Gilligan. You're hoping that the state steps up. Before we get into some of the particulars, what are you hoping to see from the Wisconsin budget, given that these federal funds are set to expire?
Well, ideally, Rob, what we'd love to see is that the state would replenish, essentially, the commitment that the federal government made back in 21-22 cycle, with the idea that these dollars provided a lifeline for many of our child care centers across the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, I heard you reference the point about how much it costs. In Milwaukee, it's about $16,000 a year for infant care. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that there are not only dollars to support the centers, but also try and keep the cost down for the parents who are also obviously responsible for the care of their kids.
And Daria, can you talk about what child care might have looked like over the last few years without this federal COVID relief funding, at least giving it some of a boost here?
Absolutely. So this program that's been funded through federal relief funds is called Child Care Count. And we had an opportunity to survey over 500 child care providers in the city of Milwaukee. And we heard loud and clear that these providers were using funds on basic expenses like rent or mortgage, on recruiting and retaining staff, on improving program quality, and critically, on reducing costs for families. We have another survey that tells us that nearly 30% of Milwaukee child care providers say that they would have closed permanently without this child care accounts program. And that would have led to significantly bigger gaps in access to quality, affordable child care when it is already quite difficult for Milwaukee families to find and afford child care.
Vincent, in that opinion piece I mentioned that you co-wrote, I want to quote here. You wrote that early childhood education is an essential need trapped in a broken business model. Families can't afford to pay more. Educators can't afford to earn less. And there is, Vincent, it seems like this double bind. It's not like a hedge fund is in the middle getting rich here. Can you talk about the strain these systems are under?
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you think about what we're talking about here is we're talking about the economy of our state, right? It's fundamental that folks have a opportunity to work, to earn a living, to support their families, but it's obviously fundamental they take care of their kids. So, you know, from our vantage point, it just makes economic sense for us to think about it at the very beginning of the cycle, and that is, you know, early childhood education. Secondarily, you think about how we improve our K-12 system. Well, getting kids a good foundation is an essential part of not only building the workforce supporting the workforce of today, but also building workforce for tomorrow. And then, quite frankly, when you think about things like public health and safety and equity, I mean, those issues are all kind of interrelated as it relates to early childhood education in Wisconsin. And we believe that, again, reestablishing the commitment by the state of Wisconsin around early childhood education is fundamentally one of the best things that our state could do.
Daria, can you talk about what a good quality access to child care can do for a kid's development?
Absolutely. So a child's brain is developing faster between when they're born and age 3 than it will ever develop again. So while some people might think about child care as babysitting, that couldn't be further from the truth. Child care truly is brain building. And when children have access to high quality child care, they are more likely to go on and graduate from high school. They're less likely to be held back in grade. They're less likely to be identified for special education. They're more likely to go on and be employed, right? The benefits go on, and it all starts at this very young age when the brain is quite literally being built.
We're talking about child care in Wisconsin, access to child care, affordability or lack of same, and a change that's coming. Some federal COVID relief funding has been giving a boost to child care that's going to expire. What happens next? It could come up in the state budget. Vincent Lyles is with us with Milwaukee Succeeds, executive director there, and Daria Hall, also with Milwaukee Succeeds, the early childhood education director. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been at a place in your life where it didn't make sense for a parent to work because it was going to cost more for child care than you were going to get paid? Have you had trouble finding good child care in your part of the state, or have you succeeded if you work in the child care business? What is the business model looking like right now? Are you able to pay people what they're worth to work there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vincent, Governor Evers did propose over $300 million to continue this kind of child care, but some lawmakers saying that's a lot of money. They're looking at a lot of different priorities in the state, from transportation, prisons. The state budget does a lot of things. Can you make the case that as a priority stacked up to others, this is a worthwhile investment?
I think so, Rob. I think when you think about it in the context of what we currently do in Wisconsin, which is roughly about $50 per kid, and comparing that to what we spend on corrections, which is about $100 a day to house someone in the correction system, I think the value proposition clearly speaks for itself. And then you think about our overall economy, where you think about we're a state where we have a lot of working families, and we want to make sure that those working families have a place, a space and a place that's safe, affordable, and provides quality care for their kids. I think it's undeniable that it makes a lot of sense for us to think about it in this context of the state simply supporting families where they need it most. And that's our primary discussion that we're having with legislators across the state. We're also asking them to think about it in the context of, as it relates to what I'll call, as Daria mentioned earlier, kind of the building blocks. Let's get to this work earlier so that when at the expensive end, when folks get into, you know, I'll call it high school or even get into college or even in the work world, or even in a negative sense where they get into their correction system, it's so expensive. If we can invest in the front end, we can certainly save ourselves some dollars on the back end.
And Daria, I know pre-COVID, I talked to people in the childcare field who said, you know, hey, it's hard to hire people. The wages aren't great. There's competition in other jobs. Well, now we hear about labor shortages during and post-COVID. When you talk to childcare providers, are they having trouble just finding people to do the job?
Absolutely. So about two-thirds of Milwaukee childcare providers are currently reporting staffing shortages. And when you have staffing shortages, that results in closed classrooms, longer wait lists, reduced hours, and overall fewer children and families being served. And I want to go back to a point that you made earlier. Let's be very clear here. Child care programs are not getting rich. In fact, but child care educators are getting paid on average $13 an hour and no benefits, right? So it's not a question of why these early childhood education programs are having a hard time recruiting and retaining staff. They are simply unable to pay these staff what they deserve because childcare is a broken business model. Parents cannot afford to pay any more than they're already paying. Early educators can't afford to earn any less than they're already earning. Other folks are coming to the table to really support this work. For example, the Greater Milwaukee Foundation has invested almost $8.5 million in childcare in Milwaukee since 2020. We know that businesses are stepping up as well. And what we're asking for is the state to step up and play its part in supporting childcare and making sure that every family who wants it has access to quality, affordable care.
Talking to Vincent Lyles, Executive Director, and Daria Hall, Early Childhood Education Director, both with the group Milwaukee Succeeds. They're with us today to talk about the challenges of childcare in Wisconsin as families, the state, and childcare centers try to figure out what they're going to do after federal pandemic funding ends at the end of this year. They're calling for the state to pick up some of what that federal COVID relief money has been doing to support childcare centers, keep them open. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see that as a priority in the state budget? Have you been dealing with this issue yourself and your family or someone close to you trying to find childcare that, A, you can get your kid into, B, that they can afford? Have you been on a waiting list 1 year, here in 2 or 3 years sometimes? And if you work in the field, love to hear your experience as well. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Vincent Lyles and Daria Hall with the group Milwaukee Succeeds. The group was created by the Greater Milwaukee Foundation in 2011 to boost educational outcomes for kids in Milwaukee. Looking at the cost and availability of childcare in Wisconsin as $300 million in federal pandemic funding comes to an end this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in childcare? What are some of the economic challenges of operating a childcare center? And for families, are you struggling to find childcare? A lot of reports out there. Maybe you are, but you're too busy with a kid to call in. I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Hi. Say a question, I guess, for the guests is, as we see more of a kind of a cultural push for women to carry a pregnancy to full term, how do you see this affecting childcare in the near term and in the long term? Is there an inverse or an adverse effect that you think we should really be looking at here? And how much of economics is really driving this?
Chris, thanks for the call. Daria, the Roe v. Wade decision came out. I don't know if people would be seeing a difference in childcare centers, but as you talk to childcare operators, is there a thought that they might be seeing even more demand for childcare for infants?
Absolutely. There might be more demand, and that would be on top of a childcare system that is already stretched thin into the breaking point. You know, let me give you just a sense. Here in the state of Wisconsin, about 73% of available caregivers for children under age 6 are already in the workforce. That gives you a sense of the demand now. And if there are more births and more families in need of childcare without additional support, it is going to become even harder to find for families, and childcare is going to become even more expensive, even when slots are available.
Thanks for the call, Chris, at 800-642-1234. Vincent, I know this is, access to childcare is an issue around the state. Are there particular communities or groups that you see hardest hit by this childcare crunch?
You know, I think it's actually much more challenging in some of our rural areas. And as we think about what this work and what this ask that we're putting in front of the legislature really means is that there are, quite frankly, a current lack of staff, lack of centers, lack of facilities, et cetera, in the rural areas. You know, obviously Milwaukee is where we focus, but we are part of a national network, and I mean a statewide network, that spends a lot of time talking through these issues. And in part, one of the things that we feel very good about is the fact that we came together as a coalition across the state and said, you know what, there are lots of issues here, but we believe this request of $300 million will make a difference across the state and will allow for a lot of those centers that would be closing or would have to reduce their staff or raise the prices on families can at least now remain open for the immediate future.
Daria, I saw some reporting. This was in the Green Bay area, I believe. Long wait lists for childcare to the point where people considering having kids are trying to get on lists and realizing, uh-oh, we better wait an extra year before having a kid. Otherwise, we're not going to have this childcare available. Is that something you're seeing a decision parents might have to face elsewhere in the state?
Yes, we're seeing that across the state. I personally am seeing that within my network of family and friends who are really thinking hard about what they can do financially and be able to kind of support their family in the way that they need to support it. And we hear those stories in communities across Milwaukee and across the state of Wisconsin.
We are talking about access to affordable and quality child care in Wisconsin as a federal pandemic aid funding that helped keep some child care centers open is scheduled to end at the end of this year. We've got Vincent Lyles and Daria Hall with us with the group Milwaukee Succeeds. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.com. investigatedhealth.org. Vincent, you've mentioned economic development, economic benefits of investing in childcare. Like, how much of this, when we talk about a worker shortage, how much do we help address this if parents are able to get their kids in childcare they can afford and then get back in the workforce?
No, I think it makes a huge difference, right? I mean, the idea is that as a family, you know, part of what you're trying to do is work as a collective, and childcare and the childcare provider plays a significant role in that, particularly in those early years, as Daria talked about, because I think, again, it's so critical for us to think about, you know, building the capacity and engagement of our kids in an early stage, right? So that parents, once their kid gets a little older, can have an ability for them to get exposed to other things. So that's one aspect of it. And then the second thing I would say, Rob, is that, you know, I think when we think about our economy is very much connected, right? There used to be a time where things that happened in Green Bay just happened in Green Bay. But now we see in a much more significant way how things in Milwaukee impact things in Green Bay and vice versa. And so this is why we're coming together as a collective and as a state to say, okay, Wisconsin, it's on you to make a difference here, and we can make a difference in a way that really boosts up the overall economy of our state.
Daria, you mentioned earlier, we're not just talking about babysitting here. What to you defines a quality childcare provider?
So we look to the state that has set some standards for quality, and that's looking at things like the health and safety practices, the qualifications of the staff, the curriculum and learning environment, and the business practices. All of these things are fundamental to ensuring that a childcare program is healthy, is a place where kids can go, thrive, learn through play and interaction with other children and with adults who are well supported in order to give the children that education and development they need.
Vincent, a big part of your pitch here is hoping the state picks up the tab for what's coming from this federal COVID relief funding. Are there other changes you think need to be made, though, other investments, other people needing to step up to help solve this problem?
Well, sure. I mean, I think this is a community, and I mean the community in the big C, time for reference, right? I mean, the business community needs to certainly support this type of action. I think education systems across the state need to also be supportive of this type of work. And certainly philanthropy, you know, with our Greater Milwaukee Foundation is leaned in, but there are other philanthropists, both private and corporate philanthropists who could also support this work. You know, our children are our future, and this is a great, great way of reflecting that in a meaningful way that can make a difference for working families in our state.
And just in our last few moments, Daria, if somebody's out there listening, thinking, yeah, you're talking about my life right now, do you have advice for someone who's trying to find childcare and so far striking out?
Yeah, so there are organizations within each community called Child Care Resource and Referral Agencies. Here in Milwaukee, it's an organization called 4C for Children. They exist to help families access childcare. So those are places that an individual can go and learn about what's available to them. And I would also just add, and Vincent has mentioned, our statewide coalition around supporting the childcare sector that's called Raising Wisconsin. If any listeners would like to learn more about this effort to secure state investment in the childcare system, you can go to raisingwisconsin.org, and there's lots of great information for you there.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to both our guests today. We've been talking to Vincent Lyles, Executive Director, and Daria Hall, Early Childhood Education Director for the group Milwaukee Succeeds. They joined us today to talk about the need for affordable child care across Wisconsin. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the high-profile train derailment and chemical fire in Ohio drew attention to rail safety. We'll dig into a big report from ProPublica looking at the impact of longer trains and shorter staffing. Plus, help for parents on a new text line. That and more Monday here on Central Time.